Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Bob. When I received your highly flattering invitation to speak at the dinner tonight, I said to an American friend of mine in London, look, I've been asked to speak in Chicago. And what do you think I would talk about? Good heavens, he replied. With a name like yours, you don't need to worry. They'll laugh their heads off before you ever open your mouth. Don't be silly, I said. It's not that kind of audience. They're from Philadelphia. And they include the creme de la creme of the American intellectual community. There'll be none of that nonsense which, Scotty Reston once quoted something of mine. And he introduced the quotation by saying, Peregrine Westthorn is not a bird or a tree, but a British journalist. Well, now, Philadelphia Society, I know, are the kind of people who will certainly recall, knowing their American history, that the first child to be born off the Mayflower carried the same name as I do. I dare say he was the first American to do so, and likely to be the last. But you didn't really invite me here to talk about myself. That's clear enough. But what wasn't quite clear was what you did want me to talk about, because the general subject I was asked to talk about was freedom and order. Well, I think I'm going to do that, because it would be difficult, I suppose, to talk to a political audience without touching on those subjects. So that's what I'm going to do. It's not going to be easy going, because I was asked to make it more a lecture than an after-dinner speech. My Bob Schrutinger on the telephone said, I remonstrated a bit about this, he said, no, the Americans like to be made to suffer. Well, perhaps he was making a joke. Well, it's always a mistake to make jokes on a transatlantic telephone. The one freedom, ladies and gentlemen, apart from that of choosing one's own government, which most of us in the West, still take seriously, is the freedom to say and write what we want to say and write. Freedom of expression. Any attempt by the state to infringe it immediately runs into a storm of remonstrance. The media can be relied upon to thunder mightily in its defense. Since this particular freedom still enjoys an almost sacred place in the pantheon of human rights, arising near religious faith and fervor. In this respect, at any rate, if in no other, it can truly be said that freedom is still a living principle, one for which people might even be prepared to die. Fine, we must be obviously grateful for small mercies, and thank God that there is at least one area of human behavior where freedom is still felt to be vitally valuable, not to say essential. But why only in this area? At a time when the state can get away with interfering, controlling pretty well every other area, why has this particular one been singled out as so specially worth defending? Now, the routine answer is that freedom of expression is overridingly important, the father and mother of all other freedoms, the only one that really matters. Now, I find this proposition very difficult to accept, except in circumstances which certainly don't apply at the present time. If one could assume that the freedom of expression would always be used to protect other freedoms, that those who make use of the freedom to write what they want to write will use it to help defend the rights of others to do what they want to do, then there might be some truth in the view that this was the one freedom on which the rest depended. Historically, this used to be the case, or sufficiently so, to help explain how the assumption grew up. British and American history contains a glorious catalogue of examples of how the right to speak and write freely was used to extend the frontiers of freedom generally. Radical writers and orators used their freedom of expression to champion the libertarian cause as a whole, very often thereby running into fierce state opposition, even suppression. This was very much the pattern of the 18th and 19th centuries, when the state had an interest, an obvious interest, in suppressing and limiting freedom of expression, since then it tended to be used to champion all sorts of causes which had to do with the expansion of individual rights and the control of the state's interference with individual rights. But that is scarcely the case today. The most influential writers and speakers today, those who make use of the freedom of expression, tend on balance to be in favor of state power and to argue for its extension rather than its limitation. Few would deny, I imagine, that in the last half century or so, the impact of the written and spoken word has been largely in the direction of aggrandizing the state at the expense of individual freedom. Far from the cherished freedom of expression acting as the great protector of all freedom, it is tended more often than not to be used by those who have very different ends in view, who have used their freedom to write and say what they feel and think, to argue the case for preventing their fellow citizens from doing much that they want to do. Now, obviously, this isn't to imply for a moment that freedom of expression isn't a vastly important principle. Manifestly it is, no argument about that, reasons so familiar that they don't need any emphasis. But what does need pointing out is that it's not necessarily the father and mother of all other freedoms, nor in all circumstances the one that deserves most respect and protection. Indeed, the belief that all freedoms are safe if this one freedom is protected can prove, and indeed is proving, highly dangerous, since those who make use of the freedom of expression, like those who make use of any other single freedom, can by no stretch of the imagination any longer be assumed to be concerned with the freedom of all. But surely the truth is that those who, for the most part, make use of the freedom of expression, who still have the skill and the inclination to do so, can only be relied upon to understand freedom insofar as it is relevant and essential to their own special activities to do with the dissemination of ideas and information. In societies where that is prevented by the state, where censorship, etc., applies, they can be expected to be against the state and in favor of individual rights, since their own lack of freedom will induce in them this general posture. But once they have won their own rights for freedom of expression, as in America and Britain has been the case for some centuries, the right to say what they want, that's been won, it can't be assumed that they will continue to do battle for freedom in general. It seems to me important that this point should be understood, since in some respects it goes to the heart of the contemporary problem of freedom. Individual freedom, it should be, it seems to me, frankly recognized, is too important a matter to be left to the tender mercies of those who make use of it only in only one of its aspects, writers, philosophers, artists, journalists, academics, and so on. The conditions which used to help guarantee their general concern about human freedom and their general determination to prevent state interference with it simply no longer apply, and haven't done so in our two countries for a very long time. because their particular freedoms have been made safe, they therefore lack that militant crusading fervor for freedom which is only produced in an individual or in a group that itself is denied freedom. What, in short, has to be recognized is that the classical group in society, which used to be relied upon to articulate and proclaim the general cause of freedom, broad terms, the intellectuals, can no longer be relied upon to do so, except insofar as it is of value to them. About freedom's absolute value in the field of artistic expression, in the media, the press, television, and so on, they're still as dogmatic as ever they were in the past. Censorship is as taboo as it ever was. Nobody must be prevented from saying or writing what they want to say or write, since intellectuals know in their bones the importance of freedom in their own particular activities. This they know from their own personal lives. But the case for freedom in these areas doesn't really need to be made, it makes itself. But they no longer know the case for freedom in a general sense, as it applies to all the other groups in society, to manufacturers, financiers, builders, traders, shopkeepers, doctors, workers, etc., all the vast variety of people who want to be free to do things rather than to say them. Now this is a new and rather alarming development, since obviously intellectuals are the natural, indeed the only disseminators of ideas, the group in society which clearly does most to set the intellectual climate. So long as they are denied their freedom, or were denied their freedom, and were therefore provoked into a general crusading disposition against the state, the climate which they set was generally libertarian, as much on behalf of others as on behalf of themselves, sympathetic to the doers as well as to the thinkers. But contrary to the general assumption, there's nothing inevitable or permanent about such a fortunate state of affairs. Rather the reverse. It's in the nature of intellectuals, once they can be assured of their own liberty, to want to improve society according to some ideal or pattern which the liberties of others interfere with or preclude, to want to encompass ideals in practice that they have thought up in theory. A free society, free that is for the doers as well as for the thinkers, is not at all necessarily congenial to the typical intellectual, who will find it tiresomely muddled and unpredictable, confused and unsatisfactory. And while it's perfectly true, as I say, that intellectuals are the best champions of freedom in circumstances where the state seeks to suppress or interfere with freedom of expression, since, to put it crudely, they've got the gift of the gab and the power to persuade and inspire, it's equally true that in other circumstances, where their own interests are not involved, they may be the worst offenders of all, being more tempted than most to see in the state a perfect instrument to impose the ideal patterns of their choice, and of course, more skilled than most in dressing up such a use of authority with fine sentiments and beguiling justifications, putting the best face on it. This surely is, or has been happening, in Britain and America in recent years. It would be fair to say that the great majority of the intellectual community show very little concern about encroachments in individual freedom by the state, except where they trespass on the still sacred rights of free expression. The liberal case for freedom in most of the innumerable areas of human activity, in business, trade, medicine, building, education, manufacture, and so on, is scarcely ever heard. Governments in all these areas can and do extend the scope and scale of their control, regulation, and interference in ways blatantly and brazenly at variance with classical liberal principles, without the intellectual community, or at least a great part of its most prestigious elements, raising many peeps of protest. Indeed, more likely than not, the intellectual community will be actively promoting and supporting such uses of state power. But only let a government seek to regulate what, say, goes into a newspaper or issue some direction to a television station, then and only then will the case for freedom be heard resounding throughout the land. Let me illustrate this with an example. The British government is about to pass into law a bill which will make it possible, indeed very likely, that the National Union of Journalists, that's the only union of journalists in Britain, will be able to impose closed shops on British newspapers. In other words, only members of the National Union of Journalists will be able to get regular work in the British press. Needless to say, editors and proprietors are getting enormously steamed up about this, and quite right too, since in effect it would mean that the National Union of Journalists would be able to exert pressure on editors, simply since if it were to expel an editor from membership of the union, he would immediately be unemployable and have to be fired. In a sense, therefore, in a very real sense, the NUJ Chapel, the union group in any paper, would be in a position to dictate editorial policy. So, naturally, there's a tremendous outcry with liberal papers like The Observer and the Guardian, the old Manchester Guardian, in the vanguard of protest. Yet these same papers, these same liberal papers, had never been, never before, so much as whispered any objections to the imposition of closed shop legislation on any other industry. They've accepted as absolutely reasonable that plumbers, electricians, carpenters, truckers should all have to join unions as a condition of plying their trade or business, and allowed unions to persecute and push around any individual workers who sought to challenge this form of coercion. Only now, when journalists are threatened with the same treatment, has the liberal press begun to wax indignant about the threat to freedom which closed shops represent. And the minister responsible for this particular piece of legislation is Mr. Michael Foot, who has hitherto been rather a hero of the British liberal press. Now, Mr. Michael Foot is a left-wing socialist, passionately in favour of nationalising the whole of industry, nationalising the land, destroying the private sector in education, in medicine, penal taxation of the rich to the point of expropriation. All these causes he's been championing for the last, nearly half a century, with great eloquence and fervour, without his reputation for being a great libertarian ever being called in question. Only now, when he seeks to challenge editorial freedom, is he beginning to fall from favour. Now, I don't think I'm exaggerating this point. I can envisage, really all too easily, a socialist government in Britain getting away with the extension of state power into every single activity, and the trade unions being authorised by the state to conscript every individual worker, white collar, blue collar, into their ranks, without such developments being seen as in any fundamental way a threat to individual liberty, so long as they were not accompanied by any overt threat to the liberty of the press. Certainly this is how the liberal newspapers, tend to judge developments in other countries. Let's take Cuba, for example. So long as Castro limited his activities to the expropriation of private property and private industry, and to the imposition of a Marxist or neo-Marxist dictatorship, he was felt to be basically on the side of the progressive angels. Far from these activities being seen as a threat to individual freedom, they were seen as entirely compatible with the idea of a free society. But only let him arrest one dissident poet, and then his fall from grace is sudden and absolute. A farmer's freedom to grow sugar and to sell it, to take that away, is fine. To take away the freedom of 10,000 farmers, sugar farmers, that is regarded as fine. But what is not fine is to stop one poet writing poetry or one journalist writing articles. That, and only that, becomes recognized as tyranny. As a result of this strangely blinkered and selective attitude to freedom, a whole generation has grown up in an intellectual climate devoid of any deep awareness of the cause for freedom in general. I sometimes wonder, for example, whether Mr. Nixon, if he abused the power of the state to interfere and intimidate businessmen, if he had made the industrial corporations a target for his hatred and paranoia, had tapped their telephones and invaded their private files, instead of, to some extent, picking on the media and seeking to use the power of the state improperly against them, whether he would, in these circumstances, have been as vilified as he has been. This, up to a point, is what the Kennedys did do, what Franklin Roosevelt, up to a point, did do before them, with relative impunity. Interfering with the freedom of businessmen, even in the most ruthless and illegal manner, using threats against them, as Bobby Kennedy certainly did as Attorney General, such behavior didn't cause any great moral outrage, since in the case of the Kennedys, it was not accompanied by threats to the freedom of the press, by threats, that is, to the one area of freedom, which still enjoys the kind of reverential respect which was once accorded to freedom in general. The point that perhaps should be made could be summed up like this. Those who articulate ideas in contemporary Western society, because their freedoms are not usually at all seriously infringed by democratic socialism, have tended to see nothing dangerous or wrong, or even unfree, about democratic socialism, which allows them to do the things they want. One of these, of course, being to devise ideal plans and purposes for other people to live up to. Far, therefore, from democratic socialism prodding them into protest, it tends, in fact, to lull them into approval, since the one freedom which democratic socialism doesn't interfere with is the only one that they really understand. Needless to say, of course, intellectuals are only a tiny section of society. But they happen, as I say, to be the section through which ideas are articulated, the section whose job it is to influence political thought, political thinking. If they choose to describe a democratic socialist society as free, and to overlook the myriad crucial ways in which it's not free, then this becomes how the public begins to see it. Since those who know from their own experience that it isn't free, businessmen, for example, who are hamstrung by regulations, are themselves quite incapable of expressing their frustrations in conceptual terms that capture the public ear. Are we to believe, for example, that in the Soviet Union today, there's not a vast mass of frustrated men and women whose creativity in action is damped down by state oppression, whose denial of a freedom to do is deeply destructive of their personalities, whose potentialities for serving the cause of civilization in terms, say, of organizing new productive processes are being cruelly held down. Of course these people exist by the tens of thousands. But unlike Solzhenitsyn, they can't proclaim their frustrations or communicate them to the world. So when we think of the Soviet Union as a tyranny and recognize its evil face, it is in terms of what it does to writers, to artists, in terms of its freedom, in terms of what it does to the freedom of expression, rather than in terms of its denial of the freedom to act freely in all the other walks of life. Not only, therefore, do non-persecuted Western intellectuals impose their own limited idea of freedom by being able to infect Western society by their complacency. But so do the persecuted intellectuals in communist countries, since their cries of freedom, for freedom, are the only ones we ever hear. To the Western public, Russia is a tyranny because it persecuted Solzhenitsyn. And since the West doesn't persecute its Solzhenitsyns, then it must be free. In this way, does the broader case for freedom get lost from view. Not for many centuries, therefore, has there been so little understanding of what freedom is really all about, the principles on which it rests, the values that it serves, and the dangers to civilization of its that flow from its absence. Precisely because those who used to illuminate these truths no longer feel the need to do so, and those who feel the need to do so are not the people who have the public ear. Of course, ladies and gentlemen, there is one notable exception to this rule, Professor Hayek, who I would like at this moment to pay my most sincere and humble tribute to. Because of all the outstanding political philosophers writing in the post-war era, he has most consistently, most bravely, and most powerfully championed the cause of a free society, not only in relation to those parts of it which every intellectual could easily cherish, freedom of expression, or those parts of it which are so obvious to all, freedom from arbitrary arrest, imprisonment, etc., but also those parts, like the freedom not to join a trade union or the freedom not to be taxed for reasons of social engineering, or the freedom in education, freedom in trade, manufacture, etc. Those freedoms which are out of fashion and for which relatively few now can see the need. It is the comprehensiveness of his understanding, in such marked contrast to those of the great body of intellectuals, and his awareness of the need to defend freedom in areas across the board, and of the logical impossibility of not accepting the disadvantages of freedom if the supreme advantages are not to be endangered, that gives his writing such supreme contemporary relevance. Yet, if I may most impudently suggest that even those writings have one flaw, or they seem to me to have one flaw. One can read the Constitution of Liberty from cover to cover, and I know of no more satisfying and stimulating exercise, without coming across a single reference to what seems to me to be the main obstacle to a free society in present conditions, at least in Britain, the hard facts of political and economic power. Because the most powerful body in the country, the trade unions, are not interested in individual freedom. This is not at all surprising. Trade unions came into existence because workers recognized that as individuals, they could not prosper in a free and competitive society, since they lacked the gifts to make good on their own. Quite realistically, they saw that their best chance of acquiring bargaining power was by being organized into a mass, the strength of which would depend on solidarity, disciplined uniformity, sticking together, acting as one. Weak as individuals, their instinct was to combine, as a result of which they have become strong as a group, eventually, of course, more than strong, since in a modern, technologically interdependent economy, they have become virtually invincible. But their strength depends on acting as a mass, on each individual worker staying in line, sacrificing his own freedom, his own individual freedom of action, for the general good. Nothing necessarily wrong with that. In many ways, the spirit of comradeship it inspires has a great deal to commend it. But a powerful group whose strength depends on its members acting uniformly is scarcely likely to be very interested in the principles of individual freedom. The trade unions today, however, are the dominant group in society, to all intents and purposes, and increasingly so, the new ruling class, whose values, ways of thinking, and traditions help determine the whole political culture, just as bourgeois values and modes of thought helped to form the political culture of the 19th century. But unlike the 19th century bourgeoisie, which understood and appreciated individual freedom, its members being being able to make use of it, to do well out of it, material interests therefore buttressing political principles, the 20th century trade union has no such understanding and appreciation, since its members, by definition, are those acutely conscious of their inability to make use of individual freedom, and also acutely conscious of the extent to which their material interest depends on its denial. Now this, to my mind, extremely difficult problem doesn't seem to me to be altogether adequately answered in Professor Hayek's great work. His solution is, which is a classical solution presumably, is simply to bring the trade unions under the law so as to deprive them of the power to behave in the manner that I described. But how is a government to be strong enough to do so in a democracy where the trade unions are so strong, in effect, as to be uncoercible, unless by a government taking emergency powers, calling in the army, etc., none of which are exactly liberal measures or ones that come easily to a government made up of liberal-minded people trying to maintain the votes of a liberal-minded electorate. Ever since the First World War, when the potential power of the trade unions was first properly perceived in Britain, it's been one of the main conservative aims to fudge this issue by a series of political and economic compromises designed in effect to outwit the labour movement. But this has meant doing what Professor Hayek deplores, abandoning liberal principles all along the line, stealing socialist clothes, acting pragmatically, becoming at times almost as collectivist as the Labour Party. But what else could be done, realistically speaking, in a society where the dominant economic group is a mass movement uninterested in individual freedom, indeed, because of its history and traditions, positively inimical to it? This, at present, is the most acute problem facing us in Britain. I realize it's not so acute for you, although I'll come to that in a moment. The British system of parliamentary government developed in response to the needs and desires of bourgeois power groups who used their group power to promote conditions favorable to individual economic freedom. And insofar as the bourgeoisie acted as a group, it was to compel governments to serve the cause of individual freedom. Capitalists never needed to impose themselves on governments, since they were capable of looking after themselves so long as governments didn't interfere. The result, in essence, was a system distinguished by governments which could afford to be weak because the reigning power groups had a vested interest in acting as individuals rather than seeking to impose their corporate will on the state. Capitalists were strong enough not to have to try to do so, and when out of excessive greed they did so try, through monopoly power, such was their social and cultural commitment to the values of individuality, and their material interest indeed in maintaining these values, that government had no real difficulty in using its authority, the authority of the state, to break monopolies up. It's unnecessary to credit capitalists with any great sense of public virtue for never seeking to withdraw capital in a concerted attempt to pressure governments, as is neither habit of trade unions in the matter of withdrawing labor. Obviously, capitalists were never sufficiently united to make such an act conceivable, since unity of that kind was against their interests. Their ethos and advantage lay in competition, rather than in comradeship or fraternity. And it was always clear to them that they had much more to gain by not bullying governments, since not only were they not suited to do so, but if they did, governments might be provoked into bullying them. Manifestly, trade unions have no such inhibitions. Not only do their members have no social and cultural commitment to the concepts of individuality, but on the contrary, a deep social and cultural commitment to the concept of solidarity. Furthermore, united action is their strong point, their very raison d'etre. What seems to me, therefore, we've got to understand is that the rise of the trade unions to great power poses a challenge for a free system of government of a wholly new kind, since they constitute a power group, the first in modern times, that has both interest in offering a united challenge to government and a disposition that makes such a challenge practicable, all at a time when the economic interdependence of our society makes such a challenge peculiarly effective and lethal. The situation is obviously paradoxical. For what makes the trade unions uniquely strong collectively is that their members are so weak individually. But this individual weakness compels and tempts them into combinations of a far more powerful kind than those of earlier groups made up of the strong, who had no comparable interest in strength through unity. Parliamentary government could easily cope with the strong, who acted as competitive individuals, but can very much less easily cope with the weak, who act as a cohesive mass. And, of course, there is one other aspect of trade union power which adds to this strength. Because all other ruling groups, ruling classes, were of their nature objects of much envy, which acted as some kind of a brake on their abuse of power. Trade unions, however, until very recently, have been spared this restraint, since although in a way they are top dogs, in another way, of course, they are bottom dogs. Individually, they arouse much sympathy, since individually they are relatively poor, modest, and undemanding. So although beginning to behave like tyrants in a mass, they can still pose with some obvious plausibility as victims, arousing very mixed feelings, as much made up of middle-class guilt as middle-class anger. Nor again do they have that stake in society which imposed a sense of responsibility on earlier power groups, since their members are obviously not conspicuously wealthy or privileged, unlike other power groups who were reluctant to damage society in which they were doing so well. Trade unionists do not in that same way share this incentive to restraint. So far as Britain is concerned, at any rate, the growth of trade union power poses, as I say, an acute and growing challenge to the assumptions of a free society. It is doubtful whether any government operating on a light rein, such as was suitable for a society made up of free individuals competing among themselves, can control the kind of power now exercised, the kind of mass power now exercised by organized labor. Now I realize, of course, that this is much more a British problem than an American one, at any rate for the time being. Our unions, much more than ours, are at least interested in making the capitalist system work so that the goose, so to speak, will continue to lay the golden eggs, which their members can share, and you do share. So long, therefore, as the goose proceeds to do that, continues uninterruptedly in the expansion of wealth, then all will be relatively well. But what if the goose begins to cease to lay? Since the end of the last war, This has not seemed a very likely development. And we've got accustomed to taking economic growth for granted. But is it reasonable to continue to do so? Is there not at least a possibility that these decades of uninterrupted economic growth were exceptional rather than normal, and that the bonanza years are about to come to an end? If this is so, and there would seem to be some evidence that it is, I can't help wondering about the prospects for maintaining a free society, one dedicated to the protection of individual freedoms, even in the United States. Perhaps I'm being pessimistic. But in the event of an economic crisis on the scale of the late 20s and early 30s, would the resistance to socialist measures be nearly as strong today as it was then? Even among the business community, in the press, in the bureaucracy, in the political parties, in what can pretentiously be called the spirit of the people at large. My guess is that a new Roosevelt would have a much easier run for his money, or your money, than the old Roosevelt did in the 1930s. I can't imagine, for example, the Times, New York Times, or the Washington Post putting up a particularly vigorous fight against a leftward lurch. And the reason, of course, is not difficult to find. Fewer people today lead the kind of lives which foster a fierce passion for freedom. Corporation executives are not used to the exercise of individual freedom in the way that the 19th century entrepreneur was accustomed to the use of individual freedom. Organizations in almost every field have become too large, too complex to allow for individual initiative. The instinct for individual freedom has wilted for lack of exercise, and increasingly the dominant mode is bureaucratic and hierarchical. This doesn't prevent people from thinking that they believe in freedom and paying lip service to its principles. But how many in practice understand the principle and would be genuinely prepared to fight for it? Let me, at this point, make my own position clear. In my view, and I think this is probably in contrast or in opposition to the basic beliefs of the Montpelerin Society, of the Philadelphia Society, there's very little chance of preserving a free society in the sense understood by the classical American liberal conservative, as it's now called, since such an ideal really would make sense only where there seemed a chance of inculcating a general disposition, posture of freedom, which would seem to me maybe possible in the days of the Virgin Continent, but is getting increasingly difficult to even envisage. Now, Mr. Chairman, the English Tory answer has always been very simple. Basically, to accept the need for a powerful state operating an increasingly collectivist society, but to concentrate with all the skill and ingenuity and ruthless sense of political sense of a ruling class, wise in the art of politics, to make sure that such a collectivist state, if it comes, is operated by the kind of people who can make the best of a bad job. But the right kind of people, the right kind of political leadership, doesn't seem any longer to be available. Liberal ideas no longer carry conviction, and Tory men no longer carry authority. In our country, of course, we are turning to a Tory woman, Margaret Thatcher, which is perhaps a measure of some desperation. But at least it's a way of buying time. An inspired piece of casting in the theatre of politics. an intriguing distraction and novelty. A spectacular change of pace. Now that, and I'm not being, I'm being almost literally truthful, that is Britain's conservative answer at the moment to the deeply dismal challenge of our times. Perhaps you have a better conservative answer to the problems of the American times. An American conservative friend of mine suggested the other day in Washington the name of Senator John Glenn, who he said could be more, who could be more above politics than an astronaut. More broad-based and wide-ranging than one who has encircled the globe. A god, so to speak, out of a flying machine. Well, a frivolous suggestion, no doubt. But in the contemporary state of politics, can one really be absolutely sure that this isn't a reason for taking it quite seriously?